Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Kelly Scarf. Kelly Scarf is a sucker for heartbreak. Her chapbook, I Fall in Love with Strangers, is available from Liquid Paper Press. Her poems have appeared in Nerve Cowboy, Labor, 5 AM, and elsewhere. She is a graphic designer and editor and lives in Greensburg, PA. Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Can you start us off with some poems?
Sure. I'm going to start with a poem about a woman I used to work with, and this poem is called Bullet Becky. After he shot her in the face, he made her drop him off at the mall to meet some friends. Then she drove herself to the hospital, but the bullet wouldn't budge. She adjusted, came back to the local newspaper, pasted sports articles onto large grid sheets. I pasted beside her, became friends with everyone else. I left her alone, afraid my stares would last too long, afraid I knew more about love, even though I knew nothing about love. I don't know how she did it, how she opened her life as if it had never been slammed shut. Her left eye had melted, the left side of her mouth a smileless heap. Her sentences wavered, each word stuck in the middle of itself. People whispered, called her Bullet Becky. I called her nothing, sat quietly while others spoke. Her heart worked fine. I think that's where she kept the words she overheard. But still, she loved. Met Robert years later at a second job at H&R Block. He held up the line to tell her jokes. He never said he didn't mind her face, but I knew. He embedded her melted eye and slumped mouth into himself. Her features became his own. It's what kept him coming back. He thought she was beautiful, felt the fullness of her blurred words. What did I know of love? A thief who steals all logic, picks the last daisy, sends fog up chilly windows. When Robert proposed 8 months later, Becky wanted an H&R Block wedding. She sent invitations with the logo, bought an ivory dress, reserved the office for a Sunday afternoon. She wanted tulips from her own garden, a new pair of heels. She wanted to start her life where her life started. The next poem I'm going to read is about my grandmother. It's called Sitting with My Grandmother. My grandmother wrapped my Christmas gift. The next day, she opened it. A ceramic snowman brushed in blue and glitter, and placed it on her television stand. She didn't know who sent it, couldn't find a card or label, only knew the blues matched her living room curtains. Some days I want to shake her. I want to grab her small, brittle shoulders and shout into her good ear, "Remember." I want her to dance again to Frank Sinatra in my parents' kitchen, cut zucchini into even blocks, write her own checks. I want her to outweigh me. The snowman isn't right on her television stand. On winter nights, she stays inside and watches Obama. She wants to live long enough to see what happens. I watch with her, offer to close the window open for days, but she cuts me off. Leave it. I like the breeze. And the next poem, my mother is a minister, and this is about a family who went to her church and their little girl got sick. So this is called Nikki Dies. Last night I sat by your body, grown blue from the breath you could not release. I sang your favorite song, You Are My Sunshine, and opened your birthday presents that collected in the hospital room for a week. You loved hats. The one I opened was pink with white specks, the same color as your Hello Kitty backpack that held your first grade books. Your bicycle leans against the garage wall where you left it, the spokes still broken from your wreck last summer. And I want to trace everything, the fairy you painted in ICU, the wet strands of your hair after a bath, your hand on the school bus window. Nikki, we've used up all our miracles. Your seven-year-old body should not look like this. God has quit and left some things unexplained. Your hand inside mine, the faint pulse in a fingertip, the sadness of our bodies at night. This next one is about a man I met in Puerto Rico. I went down there a few years ago with a group of people, and he was our tour guide. His name was Papo. He was an old man, and he told us that he was also his mother's caretaker. So his mother was wheelchair bound. She didn't have a leg, and she lived with Papo and his wife and their whole crew of children. And every night he would go home and tell her about his day. I just thought it was really sweet. So I wrote this for him. It's called The Smallest Orchid. You found it just as the rain started, its cupped pink body barely visible under rain-soaked parkas and fogged eyeglasses. You told your mother that night as you bathed her one remaining leg. I've looked for 65 years, and that's the smallest one I've seen. The sores from her wheelchair have grown past her hips and latched onto the loose skin around her stomach. You will have to rewrap the gauze again. She will apologize for not having dinner ready, for not remembering to boil the rice or season the chicken, for forgetting to crack the coconuts that have fallen across the lawn. She hasn't cooked in years, but you don't tell her that. In her mind, she still has all that life left to go. In her mind, she is that smallest orchid, stretching her cupped body upward toward the rain. This next one is about a neighbor I had in an apartment complex. And one night he lived across the hall from me, and he just knocked on my door to tell me a story one night. And it was so bizarre that I immediately wrote it down, and it became this poem. This is called My Neighbor. In the 80s, he drove for a while, hauled steel from New York to New Jersey, Binghamton to Chicago. His boss owned three barns full of white Belgian workhorses. He tells me this as I keep him outside my door, my hand on the doorknob. Things are only as complicated as you make them, he says. He terrifies me. He breaks my heart. I don't know what he does now. He speaks in platitudes, comes home late. I hear keys rattle in his lock across the hall. He said the horses were beautiful, sold for $1,000 apiece. His daughter Judy asked for one. Yesterday, I was outside when he came home. He was wearing a suit. I told him he looked handsome. He went inside and waited for me. When I got to the door, he thanked me for the compliment. He told Judy he would buy her a horse when he got the money. I see her on the street sometimes. You gotta be smarter than the problem, he says. I don't know if he'll ever get the money. Standing outside my door, he extends the conversation, calls the horses bulky. The skin around his eyes is rubbed red and raw. Every man I know is inside this guy. The cashier at the local six-pack shop, the professor that lives one block over, my father, the fresh cuts on his hands, his swing shifts at Latrobe Steel. He would never knock on a neighbor's door. His rough hands never meet the foreign grain of a stranger. But he's in there somewhere. I see him. I see all of them. The muscles along their necks that gallop across shoulders. The skin around their eyes, rubbed red and raw.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Kelly Scarfe, reading from her book, I Fall in Love with Strangers. Kelly, one of the things that strikes me most about your poems is this sense of these portraits that the poems are drawing. And in the poems that we just heard, we heard, you know, the portrait of your sort of distressed neighbor, the little girl who was dying, the grandmother who's sort of losing her memory, and the man with the taking care of his mother, and then Bullet Becky. Can you talk about the decision to sort of represent these people who seem sort of ill or lonely or sort of disenfranchised?
Usually those are the people that interest me. And I guess one of the emotions I react to the most is just kind of sympathy, I guess, or sadness. And really, I don't get to know any of these people besides my grandmother. I just kind of observe them. And I think by maintaining that kind of distance, I can it, like, the sadness intensifies, you know, because once you get to know someone, their life is fine, you know, it's their normalcy and it's fine. So yeah, I guess I just gravitate towards maybe people that I see are a little sad.
Okay. I think that that's an interesting dynamic that you just brought up, that there's a normalcy for them in that, because the poems are, they're so moving and there is so much emotion there, but they also have a sort of like redemptive quality to them. And I'm interested in that. And I'm also interested in the sort of dual elements of the speaker. It seems like the speaker is, she's obviously very caring and invested in these people, but there's also some sort of, she's not completely heroic either. You have these statements like in Bullet Becky, I called her nothing, I sat silent. And then in The Neighbor, he terrifies me, he breaks my heart. Can you talk about how you navigate those things?
I don't know if I ever really thought about how I navigated them, because they just come so natural.
Or maybe talk about how that comes into the writing. Like, are those, do you sort of check, how do you develop your speaker, I think is my question.
Okay, so I just sit down and write a story. I don't think about the poem. I just write the story. And I'm actually really bad at language poetry and experimental poetry. I just like telling stories. Mm-hmm. And the stories that come naturally are the ones that, of the people who I just kind of, my heart goes out to them and I feel bad for them for some reason. And I guess a lot of my professors that I've had have always told me to revise toward compassion. Okay. And so if there's a poem in there that starts out with without me in it or without the speaker in it, and it's just an observation, gradually the revisions get the speaker more involved and get the speaker's heart more involved, which is for me a hard thing to do. So I guess I don't, at the beginning, I don't do that. But in the revisions, I'm lucky enough to have readers who say, Kelly, get in there, get in your poem. And then that's when I just kind of bring myself in there. So
that's kind of surprising that the compassion comes from putting the speaker in instead of focusing on the subject of the poem more.
Mm-hmm. I think the compassion is there when I write it, but I think that it becomes identifiable to other readers once the speaker gets in there.
That makes sense.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, that does. Can you read us some more?
Sure. I am a big fan of Roy Orbison, and I grew up listening to him because my dad likes him. So one winter, I spent the whole winter just listening to nothing but Roy Orbison in my car, and I drive all the time. So I wrote this poem about Roy Orbison. Driving in winter with Roy Orbison. We don't need black sunglasses now, but soon, Roy, soon. Tomorrow the sun will glint off the snow that's fallen through the night, and I will listen as your crescendos chase the frost across my windshield. Elvis called you the greatest singer in the world. Your four-octave voice stretched desolate miles. We'll sing your songs, Roy, all the way back. We'll start at that motorcycle and end on notes that pull the breath from our lungs. We hold back too much, so we'll start slow. We'll sing them together in quivering pitch as if you wrote them for both of us. I think the next poem we'll read is, it's a shorter one, and it's kind of my take on Pablo Neruda's ode poems. This is Ode to the Pomegranate. I will never be as prolific as you, pomegranate. My children will never cling to my womb, bury themselves into their own shapes as bees do. They will not have translucent skin pulled taut around a tear so perfect you can see the soul. And this poem, I love the poet Matthew Dickman, and he has these just really heavy lines and long, heavy poems that just read so beautifully. And I was reading him, and I thought, I'm going to try and write a poem like Matthew Dickman writes a poem. So this was my attempt at a Matthew Dickman poem. It's called My Offer. I fall in love during car rides, at county fairs, on porch steps, holding a cigarette and a beer. I fall in love with men and women, commitment phobes and smokers, people who refuse to floss, wash their hair once every 10 days. I fall in love with shy and startled people, people who shake while speaking, people I've never met. The man next to me in the checkout line who uses his cane to point to lottery tickets. The women who pick my dirty towels off hotel floors. I fall in love at baseball games. The concession man who passes a hot dog. The stream of people who touch the aluminum foil. The brothers in the matching jerseys. The girl with nachos whose hand never leaves her boyfriend's knee. I fall in love with biologists who study butterfly migration. The ones who know the distance for the monarch's survival lies between the Great Lakes and the Gulf of Mexico. I fall in love with eyes, with crooked teeth, with Roy Orbison fans and people who put cinnamon in their coffee. Old people who remind me of my father, our Yahtzee games, his inescapable death. How terrified I am to let him go. And so I fall in love with new dads and their awkward movements. I want to offer a diaper change, a drink from my own body. This next poem is another poem about my neighbor and another conversation we had. And it kind of made me think that, you know, my mother, like I said before, she's a minister. And so I grew up with religion, but that does not mean that I'm set up in a better position than anyone else. Regardless of what people think. And so this was a poem about that thought in a conversation we had. My neighbor wants to visit Christ. He has a passport application and no idea where Medjugorje is. He wants to take his daughter to see the Christ images. It's the Virgin Mary he'll see, but I stay quiet, allow him his ecstasy. Christ comes easy to my family. He sits at our dinner table with my pastor mother, her obedient children. The world has yet to turn its cold shoulder on us the way it has my neighbor. 3 DUIs, titanium rod in leg, 2 years in the clink, a drunken crash, and dead family of 4. I sit in the second pew at my mother's church and daydream about each city she pulls from the Bible. I push my cuticles back with my thumbnail, the way my grandmother taught me. Medjugorje is in Bosnia, across the sea from Italy, 4,700 miles from where I stand. Maybe it's the closest to Christ any of us will ever get. This next poem is a short one. It's called The Waitress and Her Boss. A good day is when he doesn't ask you to show him your only tells you to pick up the crusty fork that he's thrown in front of him, then takes a step back to watch your technique.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Kelly Scarf. I think one of the things that I really want to know about your poetry is this real richness of detail. I mean, just some of the things that I jotted down while you've been reading are the I push my cuticles back with the way that my grandmother taught me, how in that first poem that you read, he held up the line to tell her jokes. There's just like there's a richness of detail, and I'm curious how you go about compiling those or how those come to you in your writing.
I think it depends on the type of detail. Mm-hmm. The cuticles thing, I just pictured what people do when they're bored. And that's one of the things I do when I'm bored. And it doesn't matter where I am. You know, it's just, I just kind of take a step back and I just think, well I want to show that I'm bored in this poem, but I don't want to say I'm bored. So what action would show that I'm bored? A lot of my detail, like the holding up the line, that was actually something that Becky had said. Oh. Yeah, so I just kind of take it and put it in the poem because a lot of my poems other people write for me because I use a lot of their quotes and I always quote them. I always give them credit, but I think, you know, I don't know anything about writing a character. I know nothing about fiction writing, nothing about developing, you know, a well-rounded character. But I always think that if the voice of the character is in there, it helps bring the character to life. So I really kind of rely a lot on the characters, the real life characters, and what they have said in conversations and in different circumstances. So I guess it depends on what the detail is.
So it sounds like it's a combination of sort of just ongoing attentiveness and then sort of imagination when you want to illustrate something.
Yes.
Related to that is the movement, some of the really nice movement that you make between sort of narrative and statement, the way you move around in a poem, in the My Offer poem. I want to offer a diaper change and then a drink from my own body, like that. There's leaps like that. Something else was the moving from in the neighbor poem, the description of like his eyes being red, mm-hmm. and then to every man I know is in this man. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. The neighbor poem, I think that came from, that had a lot of revisions, and that leap came at, I think, with the last revision, and it came because I was workshopping it with one of my old professors, and she brought up the idea of repetition in the poem, and I had been reading a lot of Hemingway at the time, and I was really interested in how Hemingway writes in a very journalistic style, but he still draws a picture with it, and that's the first thing you learn. You know, you don't tell, you show, but Hemingway tells and you still see it. So I was kind of experimenting with that when I wrote that poem, and one of my professors was reading it and she said, you should try to repeat some of these lines. So that was more to her credit than my own.
I don't know. I think you probably had something to do with it.
Well, I think that was more, that was a more conscious decision, mm-hmm. I guess, what the point is, based on someone else's more expert opinion. And as for the offer, I did that thing again where I just think, like, what makes new fathers different than seasoned fathers? Hmm. You know, like their awkwardness, you know, they're not sure of themselves. And what could I as a woman, what could I possibly do to help them? Like, what can a mother do that a father can't? So that's really how that came. You know, it's the same thing as the cuticles. I just take a step back and think logically about it. And it's just a really simple thing. And that's, I like simplicity.
I really enjoy the effect of it.
Thanks.
Just because it feels really grounded because of those details. Mm-hmm. But because I feel engaged because of those, and then I'm willing to make those leaps. I just feel like these poems are moving me through.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can you read us some more?
Sure. I think I'm going to shift out of the chapbook now. I took a missionary trip a few years ago with my mother and several people. There's a group of us, and I kind of I go back and forth with religion growing up in my household. You wouldn't have a choice but to do that. So I kind of wrote a series of poems that I didn't put in the chapbook because they didn't really fit that well. So, but these are all themed with Russia. So this is, the first one is Where the Missionaries Start. There are seven of us, like the days of the week, and we all hate certain parts of one another. My mother lingers far from the group as we approach Koyden, the village of no water, unmanicured lawns. The agenda of religion. God loves you. God loves us all. Our mouths inflate with words these children cannot translate. Let us say love as it should be. A child in the banya who stands straight under the stunted roof. The moon of the village red and low against the hatches. A young girl who dances along porch slats. The heels of her shoes wedged into the gaps. 14 days in Russia, 8 at the orphanage, and my mother pours thank yous into stretched palms. Spasiba, spasiba. While I was over there, I went over there because my mother is very trusting of everyone, and I could just see her getting into some sort of horrible situation in Russia. So I really kind of went over there because it made me nervous that she was going over there without someone to watch her like a child. And so when we were over there, I ended up learning a lot about my mother. And I also fell in love with one of the orphans. Her name was Yulia. So the whole series of poems really have this recurring character of Yulia. And this is the first one. Watching Yulia dance. Your mother keeps your sisters, but not you. And this orphan summer, the donated black pumps never leave your small feet. They're gaps large enough to fit the childhood you left behind. They slap against the concrete of the vacant churches we visit as God watches. I am here to teach you religion, and you, Yulia, are here as relief, one less mouth to feed at family dinners. You dance along these wooden slats, crinkle air with your white skirt, spin your heels into an easy life, and keep dancing even after you see me see you. If I could reach you, I'd give you a home, your own bedroom, a bus stop. But we both know it'd be easier to give you the moon. So this next one is called No Ice. When Yulia claps her head against the cement pommel horse, the woman cooking in the kitchen make her lie still against the concrete, head beside the orphan garden planted earlier that spring. When I ask for ice, Lyot, to calm the swelling, they pull from the freezer the last loaf of bread baked in winter. Okay, I'll end on a poem about my grandmother. This is in the chapbook. It's called Inflation. I spend most Saturdays with my grandmother, listen to her stories about her and her brothers selling loaves of bread in mason jars full of soup for a nickel each during the Depression. She still uses her mother's recipe, cake of yeast at room temperature, sugar, salt, 2 cups of warm water. It rises like I don't know what, she says, like breath, I think.
The poetry of Kelly Scarf. Thank you so much, Kelly.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.